help me welcome warmly the bearer of good news, Sandy B. from Tampa, Florida.
Thank you very much. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach. I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? I want to start out by thanking Bob so much. He's been very kind to me and understanding and dealt with my idiosyncrasies with much grace, and I appreciate it very much. And Joanne, that was just a wonderful talk. You can tell when people have been around a long time because they have a perspective that is just so insightful. And I really like that part about loving people no matter what they're doing will have a bigger influence on them than anything else. And it doesn't look like it should be that way, but most of the program doesn't look like it should be that way, which is what spirituality is all about. It doesn't look like it should work. I don't know about you, but the first time I saw the 12 steps, I couldn't see anything in there that was of any interest to me whatsoever. It was, especially since there was no money step. God. Well, I mentioned, it's a lot of places you start out by mentioning your sobriety date. So mine's 7 December 1964. And I still have, thank you. And I still have the same sponsor, which is a pretty good deal. His name is Bill Terwilliger. Lives up in Virginia, and he was another Marine like myself. And we both stopped drinking, but he didn't stop smoking. And so he can't travel anymore, or I'd have him down for my anniversary next week. But he's been one great influence in my life, and I'm sure your sponsor has had the same role in your life, and there's something about this passing it on. Sometimes I think sponsors are more like guides, and they're going to take us on a spiritual journey that they're still on. You know, Bill talks about it's the, you know, what is it, the blind leading the blind? And he said, no, it's the semi-blind leading the blind. And that's kind of what it is, you know what I mean? And so I like the idea of being a guide, you know, and just give me your hand, and I'm not taking you anywhere that I'm not going. It's not like I'm some psychiatrist and I'm going, go out there and do this. I'm going, give me your hand and I'll show you precisely. And we do show precisely, and I like that. You know, the message was laid out very clearly. Boy, did you think, am I going to give a talk or start another class? But anyway, it was laid out quite accurately. And as Bill said, this is precisely how we have recovered. And I really think it's important for all of us, if you're new, learn this message. And then so when you guide the next person, you are passing on exactly what was passed on to you. We don't need any ad-libbing and coming up with some wrinkles and this and that. This stuff works beautifully, and it's a great responsibility, and it's a great joy, and it really is. What a great introduction. We really are bearers of good news, because that's what this is. It's all good news. This thing is just so wonderful. I mean, when you think about God's will for us to be happy, joyous, and free, that's pretty good news. I mean, just think. Turn on the TV. You just don't hear good news like we do here in AA. It is just remarkable to be able to understand that everything that we may see is just what we see. But what we find out in here is what we believe. And, you know, this thing is filled with paradoxes. And one of the other ones is believing is seeing. And when you come to believe in this program, it becomes visible. Until you believe in it, it's not there. And it's really been a powerful tool for me to sort of exist in a world that is very powerful and joyful. And then there's all this background music going on over here, elections and stuff like that. But boy, this world is just marvelous, and I'm happy to be in it. Very briefly, my story. I've told it so many times, I'm sick of it. I feel like making up a whole new story. You know what I mean? Someday I will. You know what I think? I'm going to walk into a strange town and I'm going to be an economics professor and see. Tell them about being drunk and teaching people, you know, all these crazy theories. That'll never work. But I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut in the 30s. I have one sister, a little younger than I am. She's got 29 years in AA now up in Connecticut. So once she joined, we became a lot closer than we were before. And I was brought up in the Catholic Church. When I was 9, I had what I call a spiritual awakening. I was sitting in the front pew of staring at the crucifix. Couldn't miss it. It was 20 feet across. Pretty frightening thing for a little boy, and I'm just staring at it and staring at it because everything's in Latin and I couldn't understand it anyway, but it was very frightening. And it was as if the crucifix spoke to me and said, "Little boy, do you see this?" And I said, "Yeah." "Well, this is what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you." And I think I fell out of the pew in a faint. And so my relationship with God and the church was one of terror and fear and guilt. My sister, sitting right next to me, thought it was the coolest place, anything goes. She still goes there and thinks the nuns were fun and all that. And I'm going, "What? They were the meanest people in the world." "No, they weren't. They were fun." And I'm going, "Boy." So as you can see, it's all in the eye of the beholder. So I saw and believed in a very frightening God that I, and the last thing I ever wanted to do was die. Because I knew that's when you paid for the deal. And I just hoped to live forever and ever and ever and ever. And just the idea of dying was terrifying to me. So with that wonderful, comfortable base, I approached life and, of course, was terrified by it, very frightened, didn't know what's going on. Everybody better than I am. I don't belong. Felt like I should be on another planet. All of those feelings. And I was mystified by people talking about how great life was, how wonderful the world was. And I would think about it, you know, like, what are they talking about? I didn't have a clue what they were talking about, so I assumed they were lying and they were pretending, because I was pretending. When people come up to me, I didn't say, "I'm very terrified about life." I just said, "Hey, doing fine, great, I love it." So I just assumed everybody was making up the same story about this world and so on down. So that was what was churning inside of me, and then I'm trying to act cool because I knew that was very important. "Yeah, man, I know. Oh, yeah, yeah." I didn't know anything. So I would, but you couldn't ask questions because then they would know that you don't know. You follow what I'm saying? "Hey, can you tell me a little bit about life?" "Oh, you don't know?" So you had to, I tried to glean it from overhearing conversations, or I got some very big messages off of bathroom walls. And there was where, other philosophers of life would put the real truths in there, and you'd read it and go, "Oh my God, is that right?" And so this was all being put into the computer for me to draw on whenever I needed something to give me a clue as to what was going on. So I was filled with misinformation, but it was my misinformation, so it wasn't likely we were going to change any of it, because why would you change something that you put together? And that, as we get into AA, becomes a big obstacle. You know, I know this is my mess, but it's mine. I put it together. And it's sort of pride of authorship. Yeah, I know I always end up in jail, but at least I get there. This is me. And you know what I mean? There's sort of that thing that I thought this up, and so I'm going to stick with it. So I was a pretty good little athlete. I got high grades. And, you know, I didn't get in a lot of trouble. It was just inside was the turmoil. I wasn't a troublemaker or anything like that. My parents saved money really kind of very frugal in order to educate my sister and I. And they sent me to a little prep school in New Haven, and it funneled right into Yale University. It was just, if you went there, you were in. It was just a guarantee. And the school was so small that everybody was good. You know what I mean? Whatever sport you were going out for, you made the team because they needed you. So you felt like you were good at everything, and the classes were so small that you got a lot of attention from very good teachers. So that created good grades, and it was a very friendly atmosphere. And then, of course, I get down to the university, and it just seemed like, and I already been there. I had gotten a job in construction in the summertime and saw the guys up on the scaffolds, and I found out they were making more money, and I love to climb up high places anyway, so I got a job as a steeplejack, and that was my, where I got spending money to buy a car and do these other things. So I had already worked on a lot of the Yale buildings before I even went there, so that you would think I would be comfortable in that atmosphere. I wasn't going away to school. I wanted to go up to New Hampshire and go to Dartmouth or someplace like that and get away from my parents, but here I am. Now, the people that came in are all smart, rich. They come from all over the country, and then there's me. I felt like I'm the townie that doesn't even belong here. And, you know, these guys seem to know high society. I don't know. It's all an illusion, but that's what it looked like. I honestly believed for the first couple months on that freshman year that the dean was going to call all 1,000 freshmen out on that old campus, and he was going to get a megaphone, and he was going to say, "Gentlemen, we have found out that there is an imposter in our class," and he's right there, and he was going to point at me and get me out of there. That's how much, how uncomfortable I was in that environment. And I had not had a drink yet. I don't know why. Something, I think it was the church going to purgatory. You got 200,000 years off or something if you didn't drink till you were 21. That's my best recollection of why I'm 19 years old and I haven't had a drink yet, but that's where I was. I went to this social event. You're supposed to meet all these people. I've mentioned this in every talk. And I sat in that room. I walked in that room, and I just couldn't walk up to any group. As I started up, they all turned to me, and with their eyes, they said, "We do not want to know you. Don't approach this group any closer." And it would just take your breath away to get a eye signal that strong from all six guys. I mean, it was a glare. It was just penetrating. And as I approached each group, that's what I got. And so I just had to leave, I guess. What else are you going to do? And there was a bar there, and I decided, why not have a drink? They claim it makes you feel good, so I had one. Nothing happened. I had two. I had finally, halfway through the third drink, I put it down. I started to walk out. I looked back at those guys, and it was like they were gone. These friendly guys came in, and I looked in their eyes, and they all wanted to know me. They were not even talking to each other. They were just competing for my attention. Please. Would you join our group? Would you join? And I looked, and I never felt so wanted in my life. It was like, wow. And then I felt different. I had a little spring in my step, and I'm kind of walking like this, and I found myself in total agreement with them that they would be lucky to know me. You know. And it was like Alice in Wonderland. I walked out of a very frightening 19-year world into, holy cow, this is wonderful. I saw harmony and peace and all these friendly people who were just like me. We were all in the same family. We were all exactly the same. No differences. So I no longer felt unique and something, you know, less than or more than. I was just part of this wonderful brotherhood of man. It was a spiritual experience. It was just remarkable. So if it was that good after 2.5 drinks, what would it be like after 20 drinks? You know, that was the first thought that came into my head. And so I proceeded to have, I don't know how many, and of course I got deathly ill. And I remember the room was spinning, and I'm vomiting, and I ended up in the bathroom on that cold tile, which was to prove useful later on. We all learned how nice it was to sleep right next to the commode so you could dry heave and just be right where you wanted to be for the rest of the night. And woke up the next morning dying. Just, you know, you remember the feeling the first time you just got smashed and your body doesn't know what is going on. And I felt, you know, like I might not make it. And the thought occurred to me, well, are you going to drink again tonight? It was the fifth of a second I had the answer to that. I said, of course I am. I said, this suffering here, which is quite acute, is a very small price to pay for what I had last night. So that transformation, that magic that I had, was worth any price. That was sort of what I intuitively knew. I said, I will do whatever it takes to have that kind of an experience that I had last night. Now, the other people who started drinking that month, they didn't have those experiences. And you, if you had gone up to them and said, would you give anything to have what you had last night? They would go, no, this is nice, but no, I wouldn't give. And so the deal was being cut. In other words, if I could have read the fine print, it would have said, before you proceed, we'd like to explain alcoholism to you. Would you be willing to give up your high grades for what you had last night? And I would have signed, yeah, that'd be fine with me. How about athletics? I could give that up. How about, would you like to start going to jail and getting in fights? Yeah, that'd be all right. I'll be glad. That'd be all right. Would you give up your friends? Would you give up your self-respect, your family? Yeah, that'll be fine. I'll tell you, whatever it takes, I'd like to stay in that world I was in last night. And, you know, I'm already thinking these kind of thoughts, and I've been drinking less than a day. You know what I'm talking about? That is moving quickly in to the world that you and I occupied for so long, which is where alcohol held the key to everything. You talk about the solution, pardon the double entendre, but there was the solution. That alcohol was the solution to everything. As the years went on, I never remember saying to myself, whoops, here's a problem I won't be drinking over. This one, it's clear that this one should be addressed sober. You know what I mean? There was no such thing as addressing a problem sober. Drinking was the answer. Drinking contained the answer. And so when different situations would come along and I would be mystified by them, you know, you get your draft notice and, or you get a summons or a subpoena and you go, what do you do when you get these things? You know, they startle you when you first have them. Then you get used to them. But I would get something like that, a subpoena. I go, subpoena? What is that, a subpoena or whatever it was? I said, I haven't got a clue what to do when you get these things. You'd be nervous. But I will shortly. Out to the kitchen, get that thing, da da da. Give me the subpoena answer, you know. Two or three drinks, you intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. Subpoenas, tear them up, man, throw them away. You know, you just. So the power to make decisions was right there in the kitchen. Now, I may be exaggerating a little bit, but I think you all know the point that I'm making was that this stuff held such power and insight and transformation of the world that I would do almost anything. Now, I thought I was just another social drinker. I had no idea of knowing that I was having this unbelievable relationship with alcohol, and the rest of the guys were, they were just going, yeah, it's fun. Drinking is fun. You wouldn't have heard them saying, oh yeah, drinking. It is the absolute secret of life. If you drink, you don't need to study philosophy or anything. You just drink. You know, they wouldn't even know what we're talking about. But that's what I had. So that set me up. And the rest of my story is just how I drank more until I almost died and got to AA. But you have to earn drinking money in order to carry out this story. So that's where we all differ. I call them hobbies. You know what I mean? Well, what was your hobby? I was a brain surgeon. Oh, good. You know. But you were really an alcoholic. And that was the main part of your life, was that disease and watching how it slowly infiltrated itself into yourself, into your marriage, the relationship with your children, your job, everything. It was a controlling force. And I just thought it was one of these nice social things that you did once in a while. If I got honest with myself, this, even when I wasn't drinking, let's say that I was the officer of the day. I got in the Marine Corps, so I couldn't drink for the whole day. And then the next day I had to work. And then I could have a drink. You could have stopped me at any time during the day and said, how many hours left until you can have a drink? And I go, 14 and a half. So even when I wasn't drinking, I had an internal clock that was going, don't worry, 14 hours, you'll be having one. Thanks. Glad that makes me feel better right there. And then, don't worry, 11 hours, you'll be okay, good, you know. So that's why periodics, sometimes they don't relate with us. But if you ask them, could you always tell how many days and hours and minutes it was till the next one? They'd go, oh, yeah, yeah, I knew. It was just going to be another 21 days and I'd be drinking. And it was like, yeah, so we were never free from it. It was always in our minds as, and even after I got sober, I remember keeping a $50 bill in my wallet, which was a lot of dough, and no one knew about it. You know, and we were really broke, and I had this 50 bucks, and that 50 bucks was in case AA didn't work. You know what I mean? The guy has to protect himself. What if I'm the one guy God doesn't like? I got my 50 bucks here, you know, and so at least I can go out and get several bottles of booze, and I'll be taking care of myself. So this dependence took place even when I wasn't drinking. It was in my mind. I could think about it. I remember I'd have booze in the car in the parking lot. I'd be shaking and nervous and hurting. And just looking out the window, knowing the glove compartment was right there, would make me feel better. Just seeing that no one had moved the car. You know what I mean? I remember there was a guy in Washington. He used to go over on Sunday afternoons to Baltimore where they had a distillery. And it gave him great peace to watch the smoke coming out of the smokestacks, knowing that this was the chain of supply going to his liquor store, and that it wasn't being interrupted anywhere along the way, so that 6 months from now there might be a cutoff in the booze. And so it made him feel so good to see the smoke coming out, and that this is a amazing how fast some of us get that relationship with booze. So that's what I had. So the grades are going and everything's going, and the Korean War was going on. The draft was there, so you had to join the military. And a group of guys were drinking beer, and we said, why don't we join the Marines? Yeah, yeah. Little did we know, you know, what was coming. And God, when I arrived in Quantico and we went off for the 10 weeks of get acquainted time, it was just a terrible shock. I just couldn't believe what was going on. I had actually brought my golf clubs down there, and so this was like, you know, I said, boy, have I made a terrible mistake? What am I doing here? But we did get in shape. You couldn't drink, and the next thing, we're off for 6 months training to be an infantry platoon leader. And during that time, I got to enjoy the Marine Corps, and I got to start thinking about, God, they really have an esprit de corps, and there's really a sense of belonging. And I really enjoyed that sense of belonging. The only other place I've ever belonged is AA. And boy, do I love belonging to AA. And so I really liked it, but I didn't think I was an infantry type. And I saw a movie about pilots, a training movie. And that was very appealing. I'd never been in a plane, but it looked appealing, especially where the pilots were at a bar, and they were all talking. They had scarves on, and they were all talking to blondes that were drifting around in the background. It looked pretty good to me, and I asked about the what's this pilot stuff? And they said, oh, you don't want to do that. It'll take 3 more years of training or 3 more year commitment. And I said, oh, that'll be fine. I'll do that. I'll do that. So I end up signing up for flight school, graduated, got married to a wonderful woman. We eventually had 6 children. Unfortunately, after 20 years, due to financial stress, we got divorced, and she remarried. She's still remarried, but my kids are always telling me, don't worry, Dad, someday he's going to die, and you guys can get back together. So it's so we still have, you know, really, whenever we talk to each other, we go, isn't that a shame that we did that? But that's the way it was. And I get on a plane out of New York City to fly down to Pensacola, Florida, and I get airsick on the United Airlines DC-3. I get airsick out of Atlanta, and I'm airsick in the SNJ, and it looks like you don't have a pilot on your hands, but that went away, and I ended up being very good at it. All of a sudden, I'm going from the mess into, like, number 2 in the class or number 3, and I suddenly said, this is for me. I love it. So everything we did, we went, you know, through all the formation and instrument and carrier and all that, and I finally graduate 18 months later into a Marine fighter squadron on the West Coast and over to Japan, and the drinking and the excitement, and this is just remarkable. So I'm not going to tell you any flying stories, but I'm going to tell you about, this is what life is like for alcoholics. All I'm going to tell you about is getting my orders to leave Japan to go to Camp Pendleton, California. That's the whole story, is me getting orders to go to Camp Pendleton. So we go. I'm in Yokosuka, Japan, staging out. Navy commander comes in and says, all right, gentlemen, you're in this BOQ. There's 20 of you. The next plane out of Haneda, up in Tokyo, you'll be on. But we don't know when that plane is going to go, so stay here, or if you go somewhere, only be 5 minutes away. Okay, so we wait, and like a day goes by, and I haven't had a drink. And I'm going, he didn't mean 5 minutes. I could certainly make it over to the officer's club and back, so I tell the other guys, I'm just going over to the club and get a drink. And they're going, if the guy calls, you know, and you're gone. So I'm over at the club, I have a couple of drinks, I run back, they're still there. I said, see, they're just screwing with me. We're going to be here for weeks. So I go over to the club again, come back, they're still there. And I said, you know, I think I could make it back into town. Because there's all those bars that I said goodbye to. I got time to say goodbye to all those bars again. So I got in a cab and raced down to Yokohama, raced around the bars for a little bit, said goodbye, drove back, they're still there. So the next night I said, I think I'll go down and say goodbye one more time. Well, this time I stayed a little too long. And I woke up in a bed and I'm lying there and I don't know the room that I'm in. It's a very small octagonal room. And I'm looking around the room and it's daylight. And there's drapes with ship's wheels on them. So I got this feeling that it's Navy. And I hear voices, and I start looking around, and I see an iron spiral staircase going down. And I realize I am in the officer of the day's bed at the main gate of Yokosuka. And the shore patrol guys are down below. We're working the gate with people coming in and out. And I go, God, how'd I get up here? And I look, and there's a note pinned on my uniform from the officer of the day. And it says, Lieutenant Beach, you are a disgrace to the United States Marine Corps. You came rolling out of that cab at 3 a.m., totally passed out. We had to get money out of your pocket to pay the cab. You've missed your flight back to the States. Report to Admiral Brown at 10 o'clock this morning. So I'm on a good start getting back to the States. So I sit there with the note, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I'm just going, God almighty, this is awful. So I went downstairs, and the shore patroller giving me a hard time. Good morning, Lieutenant. Good morning. How you doing? How you doing? How you doing? And I'm just going, this is not funny, guys. When did they leave? So they told me they left about an hour ago. And I said, an hour ago? So I raced back, I got my duffel bag, and I got a cab, and I signed my own orders out of Yokosuka, took a cab to Anita, got there and checked in, and I said, has the plane gone? No, the planes won't be leaving for a couple hours. They explained where to take my stuff, and here's the paperwork you had to fill out. So I've got all that done, and I've got a beer going when the bus shows up with the other guys. And they see me sitting there, and so I came over and said, here's what you do. You take your stuff over there, and you check your bags in, then you got to go fill these forms out. And I suddenly had gone from being in total trouble to in charge of the situation. And I was relying on the fact that I'd be all the way back in the States when I didn't show up at that admiral's office, and they would just go, well, if the guy made it, then we're going to let him go, which is what they did. So I arrived in San Francisco, called my family. I said, I'm going to get the next plane back to Washington, and I'll call you when I have the information on it. And I'm staying in the Marine Memorial in San Francisco, drinking with a few friends. I had about $500 in cash to buy my airplane ticket. It was before credit cards. And I started out to go to the airport, and I came to on a train in Los Angeles with my sea bag and no money. And I get off the train on a Sunday morning in Los Angeles. These are the challenges that I don't miss anymore. I get off the train. I have no recollection. I must have gotten drunk and thought I was supposed to go directly to the base, which was near Los Angeles. And I got off the thing with the sea bag. And back then, it was still a carryover from World War II. And if you were in uniform, you got cut a break sometimes. And so a cab driver agreed to take me out the airport for nothing. So I got out to the airport and went to the bar and started hanging around. You know how you just hang around the bar, people are drinking, and somebody go to the bathroom. I could get a little bit of their drink. Because I knew if I could get enough alcohol in me, I could think and solve this problem, because I was shaking and trembling and hurting. So I would wait, and somebody would leave their change, and I would get the change, and I'd go to the other end of the bar and buy a drink. And pretty soon I had gotten about four or five drinks in me so that I could now have a conversation with somebody. And I started talking to somebody. He agreed to loan me about $10, and that let me drink enough so that now I was totally confident again. Went over to the airline counter, and back then they would let you actually write counter checks. This is really going back in time, because there weren't credit cards. And so I said, here's my ID and all that, and I need to get to New York. And the guy said, all right, well, what's your bank? Well, I didn't have a bank, because I've been overseas. So I've gone to New Haven, Connecticut, so I said, every city has a First National. So I filled out First National Bank in New Haven and wrote the amount. Got to New York, they picked me up, the big homecoming, but I'm obsessed with getting up to New London, Connecticut to get a special pay so that I can go find if there is a First National Bank of New Haven to deposit enough money to cover that check, which I did. That's a pretty complicated way of getting home from, you know what I'm talking about? So life is a lot more complicated for alcoholics than for other people. Because that was just the story about me and my orders coming home from overseas. And things like that, I think, happen to all of us. And so when you add all that in, you can see that I was getting ready to hit the bottom. And the bottom came in the flying part of it, where I was having withdrawals in the planes. And these planes were high performance. They were single-engine fighters. And you really had to be sharp. And I was getting in these planes after not drinking for 6 or 7 hours, which was the law or the rule. And I would start, my heart would start racing. I'd start sweating, and I couldn't see the instrument panel very well. And I was, you know, not thinking very well. So things were happening in the plane that were dangerous. And that was scaring the hell out of me. But I had to keep flying because I'm the only guy in the plane. I mean, you got to... You can't turn it over to the other guy. And so it was like, I'm flying every day, but I don't want to fly with me. You know, there was that do I have to go up with him again? You know, there was that feeling. But then there was the macho, what do you mean? I'm the hot shot, you know, and all that. So this is going on for probably 6 months before I finally had a couple of close calls, and one time flew around with one hand on the ejection seat because I thought I was going to pass out, and that was my secret answer. If I fall forward, I'll fire myself out. The plane will crash, the chute opens automatically, and I'll be safe. And as ridiculous as it was, I felt superior that I had thought that up. You know what I mean? Like, there was that part of me that was going, well, they almost had the old fox, but he figured his way out of this one too. And so it was very bizarre. And I talked to the doctor, and to make a long story short, they did not understand alcoholism. There was no such thing as alcoholism. So I had to be diagnosed with something else. And they said that I've been flying for 12 and a half years. It was a childhood fear of flying that just showed up out of the blue. You're no longer allowed to fly. So that just crushed me, but I had nothing inside to fight it. I had no backbone left. I mean, whatever happened, that was what was going to happen. Just give me a drink. I'm pretty sad because that was the most important thing to me. And boy, every time I go over to the Pensacola Air Museum and see all those planes and everything, I just really wish that that one little part had been different, that I didn't lose that career, but I did. Anyway, I got reassigned as an air traffic controller. And I spent my last year of drinking as in charge of an air traffic control unit in Japan. But the enlisted men saved me. They wouldn't let me near the radar. Captain, just go over there and try to stay together. They saw that I was an alcoholic and was dying, and so they just had me drink coffee and sit over on the side, and they did all the work. And during that year, I lost about 50 pounds from what I weigh now because I couldn't eat anything. And so I just drank juice and vodka. That was how I tried to survive. I stopped hanging out with my buddies. I didn't even go to happy hour with these guys that I thought were the greatest. I just wanted to be alone. And so it was very scary and lonely during that year. Made it back to the States into some kind of a career school. And I remember at that school, I would be disoriented. I would go in the wrong classroom. I'd be at the wrong table. And the other officers are going, what is wrong with that guy? Well, today we would know. We would have intervened 2 years earlier, and I'm just going around, and came into Quantico from, I lived off the base, and I came in the base one day, went to the school, and it was gone. All the buildings were gone. So I went back to the main gate to report it, and I was just on the edge of a breakdown, and so I was hallucinating, and I went back to the gate and told the corporal, I said, Corporal, the junior school is gone. And he said, it is? I was a captain. I said, Captain, it's gone? I said, yes. And so he got his car out with the siren. He said, follow us. And we went up. We got up there. It was back. So I said to him, he said, there it is, Captain. I said, well, it's back. And so I'm sure they went back to the guardhouse, and I can just hear them down there going, you're not going to believe this. But anyway, in that school, then I had a grand mal seizure, and I bit my tongue and down. Now I'm in the ambulance, and I'm in the hospital. 5 days, they studied me. What could have caused that? And then I went in the DTs, terrifying DTs. The CIA was trying to break me, and they were doing memory tests. And oh, jeez. It was just awful, and I guess I started screaming, and they captured me and put me in a straitjacket and locked me up for 6 months. So that was where I finally crashed. And even in the nut ward, there was no AA, there was no alcohol. You just went and did what other mental patients were doing. But AA got a meeting in there after I'd been there about 3 months. And I heard about AA, and when I got out, I drank one more time, and I knew I was going to get caught. So I dialed AA on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964, and my sponsor, another Marine captain, came over, took me to a meeting, just basically took over my life. I think he said, well, we'll be going to a meeting every night for 10 years or something like that. And it was just, I just did what I was told. And I remember about 3 months, I was sober 3 months, and we heard about a guy out in the McLean, Virginia group that had had a slip. And it went all over, you know, AA, the great rumor mill. Sully out in McLean had a slip. I didn't even know what it was, you know, so I said, what's that? You know, a slip. Oh, I'd put on a slip like a girl or what? I didn't know. Didn't even know what it was. And so they said, no, he had a drink. I said, wow. So I asked my sponsor, I said, what is a slip? And he said the perfect answer for me. He said, you're not allowed to have one. And completely misunderstanding that, I thought when you came in, they looked at you and they went, yeah, he could have a slip. And they stamped that guy a slip. And then this guy, no, you can't have one. So anytime I thought about having one, I said, oh, I'm not in that category. So I can't have one. So I may have avoided having slips in the beginning by default because I misunderstood what the thing was. But whatever it was, I didn't have a slip. So I've just been sober ever since. And I went to a meeting every night for 2 years, did everything that I was asked to do, made coffee, spoke at meetings, was starting to sponsor people. The first year we were in, we both came up for promotion to major, and neither one of us made it. And if you get two tries, and if you don't make it, you're out. The second year comes up, he got promoted, and I didn't. So now me and my 6 kids and my wife are out in the streets. No retirement, no benefits, just thank you for your 14 years, goodbye. Now, I don't know why. I thought that was unfair. Unfair? I thought it was outrageously unfair. You go to a meeting every night for 2 years, you have this loving God, and now we have 8 starving people. You call that fair? So I got a resentment out of that that was up in the stratosphere level of resentment. It was one that probably should never be let go of. No matter how powerful the program is, there are some things that are just beyond the pale. You know what I mean? Yeah, got cut off in traffic. Yeah, you know, forgive the guy. And I just talked about this. I was the most boring guy you could talk to. You know, if anybody, you know, Sandy, this is Fred. Fred, you want to hear what happened to me? That was it. If you met me, you heard about my problem. And I was trying to get you to agree. Isn't that awful or whatever? Like that was going to change something. But it's all I talked about was this outrageous injustice. And gee, I don't know why I didn't get drunk, because I just nurtured that thing. And about 4 months after I was out, I was reading the Washington Post. There's a little short story. It said, Marine Corps instruction team killed in plane crash in Denver. If I had been promoted, I would have kept that job. I was on that instruction team, and all my buddies were killed and going out to do a show in Denver. And I looked at that thing, and I knew that God knew. I had just read it, because I'd been having a long conversation with him about what a jerk he was and how unfair. And so I knew that he knew. I had just read that. And there was a sudden, I didn't know where to hide. So I mumbled something like, well, if you just told me this was going to happen, I would not have been resenting all this time, you know, which didn't really cover it. So if you've been having unfair things happen, just wait a while and all the answers will come. There's probably a connection to everything. Because that started, I eventually got into some sales jobs, and then I ended up in complex things in simple terms and try and get the credit unions from being crushed by the banks. So we had the good guy and the powerful enemy, and it felt like a very noble cause. And so I did that for 20 years and ended up retiring, and everything turned out well. And I ended up on this path that we're all on. So just a couple stories. One was I've been sober about 25 years. And I was getting ready to watch the Washington Redskins. If you're in Washington, obviously, you're a Redskin fan. And the game was starting at 1 o'clock, and I had already been to church. I had gotten some bagels. I had, you know, I was getting ready for the game. I had Cokes and potato chips, and it was about quarter of, and I'm sitting on the couch, and I get a memory bubble from 1955. I'm a flight student in Pensacola, and my best friend Bill Marseille and I was married, he was a single guy, and we all partied, the three of us partied together, and every month I'd be broke, and I'd borrow the rent money from him, and on payday, I'd pay him back. Well, on this time when we even transferred out of Pensacola, he got transferred before I did, so I never paid him the $70. And then the next time I saw him, I pretended like I forgot. And then we just never crossed paths, or if we did, I never mentioned it. So this $70 surfaced at 10 minutes to 1. And I'm going, oh yeah, Bill Marseille. But you, after you've been around a long time, you get this other part of you that's going, well, you got to fix this. And I say, yeah, but not in a Redskin game. Yeah, what are you talking about? We got, you can find him. I said, I can't find him at 10 to 1. So here's this debate going on. I said, how am I going to find him? The headquarters, Marine Corps, no, I don't know where he is. Well, he likes to ski. Yeah, but there's a lot of places where they ski. Yeah, but he was from New England. Yeah. He's probably in Vermont. And I remember just going, will you shut up? It's 5:01. You know what I mean? Just, Jesus. Will you give me a break? So it's almost like this voice said, all right, well, here's the deal. You call information in Vermont and see if he's there. And if he's there, you call him. If he's not there, you're off the hook for a while. I said, all right. Then I went to the dial information. Hello, he had a very unusual name. I said, hello, do you have a William P. Marseille III in there? And they said, yes. And I went, oh, God. So I get the number. It must have been 2 minutes of one. So I'm going, dit, 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 dit. I'm hoping he's not going to be home. He answers the phone. Bill, yeah, Sandy Beach. Yeah, hi, Sam. Oh, yeah. Listen, Bill, listen, I'm in a hurry. I didn't tell him the game was coming on. I said, Bill, you remember then in 1955, and I used to borrow the rent money? He said, vaguely. I said, Bill, trust me. I borrowed it from you. I need your address. I got to mail it to you. I'll make it like $250 with the interest, 25 years and all that stuff. I just have to mail it to you. He says, why? I said, Bill, I'm in a program, and you just have to do the stuff that's in there. Trust me. Well, what's the program? AA. Oh, he said, yeah, you did drink a lot. And I said, yeah, I ended up in AA. It's about 25 years ago. I'll tell you, it's been the most amazing life. I can't tell you. I don't have time, but this has been this has been the most amazing thing. Blah, 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 blah. Give me your address. So I get the address. The game comes on. I wrote the check, mailed it out the next day. Probably a week later, he owned a gift shop at the ski resort. So he sent a box of stuff, and was more than $200 worth of stuff in the box. All kinds of wind chimes and gifts and this kind of stuff. And then he called one other time. He said they were moving to North Carolina, gave me their telephone number. We promised we'd look each other up. Gone. So like 10 years later, I'm speaking at a convention in North Carolina. And I finished the thing, and people stand in line. This charming woman came up and said, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Kathy Marseille. It's an unusual name. And I said, oh, Bill Marseille's wife? He said, no, I'm his widow. I said, oh, God, what happened? He said, oh, he died of a heart attack a couple of years ago. So I said to him, I said, well, what are you doing here? And I looked, and she had an Al-Anon tag on. And she said, oh, didn't he tell you? After you called him and you told him how great AA was, he joined. He was a terrible alcoholic. He had 7 years sobriety when he died. And so what was going on that Sunday afternoon was we needed somebody to 12-step Bill Marseille up in Vermont, and I was selected, very reluctant that I go along with it. So when events happen, they're not happening to us. We're just part of something, and we always are. And sometimes we'll find out what it is, and other times we won't find out what it is. But when we think in terms of being part of something, so something adverse happens to you, maybe there's a reason that you got a flat tire, because you're going to meet the person who helped you, and then you're going to 12-step that person's father. And all these events that happen in life, we shouldn't judge them at all. Dr. Paul's right. Just accept them, because it'll be revealed what it's all about later on. And I've had so many experiences like that, where something happens and you just assume that it's just a bad deal, and then it turns out that you've played a very crucial role in something. So I've come to believe that when you get these little hunches, or you get this something urging on the inside, that pay attention to it, because it could be leading to something incredibly useful. I know this may sound mumbo jumbo if you're brand new, but you're being guided by your sponsor and your groups towards your fulfillment as a person. This is the main event on being alive, and that's why that sixth step, you know, separates the men from the boys, the girls from the women, is such a huge thing, because it's talking about going for perfection instead of a limited objective that we settle for ourselves. It's suggesting that we be used to be taken as far as we can be taken, and that therein will lie all of the happiness and satisfaction of our own lives. And that to try and dream that up on your own and then achieve it is to cut yourself short. My sponsor used to hammer that into me. He said, if you could have your choice between God's will for you, just get guided a day at a time, wherever the hell it's going to take you, or you can have anything you want, don't take the one you can have anything you want. You take this other one, because it'll take you to places you didn't even know to ask for. And he said, look at AA. Would you have ever asked for AA when you were a practicing alcoholic? And what's the most precious thing you have in your life now? Was something you never even knew existed. But you got led here. You hit a bottom and you just got guided. So for the rest of your sobriety, you can be guided towards the ultimate fulfillment for you. Where is the most important place for us to be? Everyone in this room has special talents of usefulness, not of selfishness. I like to use the resume. Somehow that just captures what I'm trying to describe. When you write a resume, you write it in terms of an entitlement document. I don't know if that's what you do, but that's what most of us do. Let's see, if I put down this, I should get $5,000 a year more. Don't forget this. And we just bring this thing out, and then we send it out, you know, with everything on it, so that when they see us, they'll go, now there, that guy is, you know, he's worth $100,000 a year. Look at all these qualifications. And so when we go on an interview, we're there going, what can you do for me with this great resume that I've given to you? Now, when you get in the program, you could take the same document and the energy would get reversed. And you would suddenly see that all those accomplishments that you have on there, whether it's a PhD or a master's or training in this or training in that, is that those are God-given gifts that you have that are just gifts. And that's why you did so well in those areas. And that what this document says, these are all the God-given talents that enable me to be very useful to your company. And I would like to come and share this talent with you in order that your company do well, in order that the people at your company can benefit from my being there, because I would be a team player and I would love to be part of it. And you have become an individual program of attraction. And that is very appealing in today's world, when you are just, the energy you are admitting is, I am here to give something. I'm asking for nothing. I just want the opportunity to do all this. And you just, you know, Chuck Chamberlain talks about this all the time. And you go, well, how do you know you get paid anything? You don't. Just try it. And, you know, that was what he was saying. I remember I'd go up to Chuck and I'd say, Chuck, what did you just say? He said, it's not your job to take care of yourself. That's God's job. Your job is to do God's work. And I go, Chuck, that sounds good in the theory, but you keep like money in your wallet, right? I mean, you know, you can't really believe that. And he said, it's not your job to take care of yourself. That's God's job. Your job is to do God's work. You will be taken care of beyond your wildest dreams. And that takes a lot of faith, but I really believe in that. I believe that this is how to go, what Bill's talking about, into the fourth dimension of existence. It is an area where you no longer are concerned because it's not your business. So who cares if this turns out this way or that way? That's not my job to worry about that. My job is, where could I be useful here? Where could I be useful there? And I did that in a couple of jobs, and I kept getting promoted. Never would ask for it. I got some bonuses. I got sent to places that were just absolutely wonderful. And I just look back on it, and I go, well, was that a coincidence? Or did this really happen as a result of trying this program? In closing, I'll say the greatest gift that you have, if you're new, is yourself. And AA is going to unwrap it for you, which you've never done. You've been afraid to look in there. You're going to find that as you strip away this ugly wrapping, most of us come here looking pretty awful, and you allow this process to unfold, that you're going to find one day you look in the mirror and you're going to see a person that you think is absolutely marvelous. And you're going to recognize that you've been this person all along. This desire to be useful and loving and helpful has been inside of you, but it's been covered with character defects and old ideas that we learned when we were little that is preventing the real you from getting out. And that's been the tragedy of our lives, is to sit inside of this selfish, ego-contained thing, dying to get out, to be a loving person, and we get set free here. And if you knew, it's not very far. It's going to happen. And that'll be one of the greatest gifts you ever get. Thank you. Sorry I ran so long.